From the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Farm and Country. I'm your host, Kimberly Izar. It's Saturday, November 15th. Well, depending on where you are, if you've looked outside your window this past week, you may have seen some snow. Did you know that snow is vital to not only our reservoirs, but also our entire ecosystems, economies, and agriculture? On today's show, we lean into the science of snowfall here in the Northeast with Dr. Marco Tedesco of the SnowX Research Project and what measuring snowfall can tell you about your community. Plus, we chat with Jess Lewis of Mama Garden Co. on how to keep your gardens healthy throughout the winter and what plants can breathe new life into your winter garden. All of that in Keith Hubbard's Star Talk report. But first, news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. With the government reopening this week, air traffic controllers have been paid for the first time in more than a month. NPR's Joel Rose reports the Federal Aviation Administration says they have controllers receive their first installment of their back pay.
Air traffic controllers received about 70% of the take-home pay they earned during the shutdown, according to the Department of Transportation. They're supposed to get the rest later this month, including any overtime or shift differential pay they've earned. Those can be significant sums because many controllers work 6 days a week with mandatory overtime. Controllers had been required to work without pay since the shutdown began. Some took on second jobs, and many called out sick, leading to staffing shortages at many air traffic control facilities. But most controllers now seem to be back at work, with only a handful of staffing shortages reported in recent days. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
The FAA has begun taking steps to restore flights at the nation's airports, citing improvements in staffing levels at air traffic facilities. Traffic reductions at a dozen major airports will be lowered from 6% to 3% this weekend. At the annual UN Climate Summit, host country Brazil's proposal for an accelerated roadmap away from fossil fuels appears to be gathering support. Developed countries such as Germany and Britain and developing nations, including Kenya, are backing a scheme that would see the world move away from coal, oil, and gas at a faster rate. Australia's Energy Minister Chris Bowen is also on board.
Renewable energy investment, double the investment in fossil fuels around the world, $2 trillion, which shows that the rest of the world understands that what's good for the planet is good for your pocket. And we understand that in Australia as well. The Australian government knows it. Australian industry knows it.
The summit being held in Brazil, hundreds of demonstrators marched today. The Trump administration declined to send a U.S. delegation to the summit. YouTube television subscribers can now access Disney programming again after a two-week blackout prompted by a contract dispute. NPR's Matt Bloom reports the two media companies settled on a distribution deal late Friday.
Disney executives said in a statement they were restoring content in time for viewers to watch weekend programming, including college football games on ESPN. The company pulled its channels from YouTube TV late last month after talks broke down. Disney said the streaming giant had refused to pay fair rates, while YouTube TV said Disney was proposing costly terms that would lead to higher prices. The companies didn't release specific terms, but YouTube said it preserves value in its service. Morgan Stanley analysts estimated that the lockout cost Disney about $30 million a week. Alphabet, which owns YouTube TV and Google, is a financial supporter of NPR. Matt Bloom, NPR News.
This is NPR.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The government shutdown is over and SNAP benefits are back, but for many families, food insecurity is still very real. A Single Bite has been feeding families in Sullivan County for 6 years and says demand for its prepared meals has doubled since September. Executive Director Audrey Garrow says the problem goes deeper than missing benefits.
I think since September, we were feeding 625 people. Today, 1,200 people. So that's double. And some of that is ironically, thanks to the increased visibility and awareness people have about food insecurity through this SNAP crisis, more people have been reaching out to us, which is fantastic. I think the other part of it that continues to be disturbing is that these individuals are not going to call us tomorrow and say, I have my SNAP benefits back. I don't want your healthy, prepared food anymore. I don't need it anymore. My kids are still getting enough nutrition. That's just not going to happen.
Garo says the return of SNAP benefits has not eased the long-term fears families face.
Because we live in a county where there is generational poverty, where transportation is an issue, where people's income opportunities are limited, this problem is not going to go away. And that just because the news cycle changes, these families still need our support. And it's not easy to ask for help.
You can find a list of local food pantries and resources at wjffradio.org. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities, and the listeners who support this NPR station.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Farming Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. Well, this week, you may have seen some snow flurries outside of your window. And I don't know about y'all, but for me, there is something so elementary and joyful about snow. And you probably already know this if you're in the Northeast PA and the Catskills, but snow also has a really important role here in our ecosystems. Well, last week at the Catskills Visitor Center, there was a training on how and why collecting snow in the Catskills matters, as well as how residents can do it. I chatted with Dr. Marco Tedesco of Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory in Nyack about the Project X Snow. It's a NASA-supported research project designed to better understand how snowpack changes over time and what it can tell us about our landscape. Here's Dr. Marco Tedesco. What exactly is snow and how does it form exactly?
Snow is basically, you know, people who live in the Catskills, they know a lot about snow. I don't want to hear and teach them what snow is. But of course, you know, when snow is forming in the sky, one thing that maybe people might not know is that you need the nuclei around which the snowflakes form. And of course, and we know that no snowflakes is similar to another. And actually, when you look at snowflakes on the ground, they can tell you the story of the atmosphere through which they go through. And so the shape of the snowflakes, it tells you exactly what's the temperature, humidity, and of the atmosphere as the snow falls. But the snow is really important. It's really important for many reasons. People think about snow for school days or as this entertaining medium. In reality, snow is very important for economic purposes, for a lot of reasons. In the West Coast and the West part of the United States, there is much more snow, and it lasts much longer than the East Coast. It's used for agricultural purposes, drinking purposes, and of course, snow can insulate thermally, can protect from freezing vegetation, and can reflect a lot of radiation from the sun back in the sky, keeping things cooler and basically impacting the way the temperature and the weather evolves around. But on the East Coast, there's very little information about this. And snow on the East Coast is very different. It comes and goes. It doesn't have these 3, 4, 6 feet of snowpack during the winter, but it stays very shallow, but very crusty because of the rain, the wind, the vegetation. And so whatever we know about the snow on the West Coast is very limited in terms of applicability to the East Coast for the purpose of understanding how much snow we have on the ground, how much snow has been melting sooner or later, and what's the effect of climate change on the snow on the East Coast.
I mean, that's so interesting, especially because we do get so much snow here on the East Coast. Why has snow not been studied so much?
Well, I think it's mostly for cultural and economic reasons. Because of the strong polarizing effect of the economic aspect on the West Coast, and because of the longer persistency of the snowpack, a lot of effort has been put in this direction. Historically, you know, the snow in the Catskills has not been considered to be, I wouldn't say worthy, but interesting enough to attract investments that could return in terms of products that could be of interest for applications. And therefore, the East Coast has been receiving much less attention in this regard. But there's really no pre-intention of penalizing one or the other. It was mostly historical.
Why don't we talk a little bit about the X Snow Project? Tell me what it is and how it's been going so far.
I feel that I'm going to state the obvious when I go visiting people in the Catskills, you know, but when you, because, you know, of course, snow is important. They said, dude, they know, we know about it. Why do you have to be a professor at Columbia to tell us what you already know? And I think this is exactly the beauty of, what we're trying to do is that we're trying, when it comes to citizen science, which is basically what the project is based about, and citizen science, just to anticipate your question, is basically a branch of science where citizens can help collecting data that can be used for scientific purposes. And is as rigorous as basically data collected by scientists. And so having the citizens contributing is not only helping us to collect the data that we need, but it's also helping us to get the people engaged about the problems that we're trying to address. And of course, they're going to provide us information that we would not be able to know. And we can have a much better job in terms of delivering the information needed to the community.
For folks, the X Snow Project, it essentially means that residents here in the Catskills can measure and report on snowfall directly from their backyards. Dr. Tedesco, can you talk a little bit about how people can exactly do that?
Absolutely. Look, let me also tell you one thing. The reason why the project is called X Snow is because one thing that we realized is that everyone has the superpower to give us the information and mm-hmm. collect the data. And so every citizen becomes a superhero. And then from X-Men, we thought about X-Snow. So for people to help us, they can, of course, go to our website, which is xsnow.us. There are different ways. There are different tiers. There's a tier one in which you basically measure only the snow depth, how thick is the snowpack. And in simple terms, you stick a ruler in the snow and you take a picture and you send it to us. The second tier is basically similar to tier one, but it's repeating multiple measurements of snow depth along a path to understand how variable it is, and eventually add some temperature or albedo information. Albedo, which is basically how bright is the snow. And the third tier is really for the hardcore people who are trying to measure SWE, the snow water equivalent, which what does it mean? It means that how much water is really stored in the snowpack. You can have a foot of snow, but if it's very fluffy, it will only fill, let's say, a quarter of your bottle. But if the snow is still 1 foot, but it's very dense, it will fill the whole bottle. And so for hydrological purposes, for understanding really what the impact of snow is on our water resources, we don't just need to know the depth, the thickness, but also how dense, how much water is stored. And for us, the more people we have, the better it is, but also the more measurement in the same place we have is very important. And this is exactly why, for example, citizen science is important. If you live in the Catskills and you have snow in your backyard and you wake up every morning and you can take a measurement or every couple of days, we can't be there every day. And right. So this is really the power. If you spend 2 minutes of your time in your backyard or in your schoolyard collecting this information for us, it's going to multiply the effect incredibly from an economic perspective for us, but also in terms of data, data richness. And this is going to make the big difference.
And just to put a fine point on this, can you explain why is this data and these measurements, this project, so important, especially right now, as we see and we try to understand the impact of climate change in our region?
You know, we have satellites, again, that are looking at Earth from space. And so they can measure the snow depth or the snow cover. However, imagine that you had a camera, you have your phone, and you would take a picture of your phone of something, of your car, for example, of, I don't know, let's say of your dog. And then it's very crispy and you can get a lot of information about the color, the you know, the breed and so on. But what if you take your phone and you go up to, let's say, 1,000 miles or 500 miles in space? How blurry is that? And every element of this 3D modeling satellites and work on the ground, they are all crucial to understand what's happening, why the snow is disappearing sooner, why the snow is coming down much harder in short periods, and what can we project in the future is going to happen. And again, this is not just to combat climate change. It's not something that is either political or science versus non-science. This also has incredibly important reverberations for the economy, for the people who live in the areas, and that's their home. I think you have the right to know what's happening as much as you can to the place where you live. And that's what we're trying to do.
Well, folks can get their rulers and get ready for the snow season. You can head on over to xsnow.us for more information on how to get involved. Dr. Tedesco, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Up next, you know what time it is. This week's Star Talk Report from Keith Hubbard.
For Farm and Country, I'm Keith Hubbard, and this is Star Talk. From now until the end of November, the Leonid meteor shower will be occurring. The meteors will appear to radiate from the sickle in Leo. The best time to see the meteor shower will be in the late night and early morning hours. At that time, the sickle will be high in the southeast, and the nighttime side of Earth will be moving head-on into the meteor stream. The best place to view the shower will be a dark location away from city lights. During the shower's peak, which will be the evening of Sunday into the morning of Monday this year, you can expect to see 10 to 15 meteors per hour. The waning crescent moon will rise 2 hours before the sun on Monday and will not affect viewing conditions. The meteors will come from Comet Temple-Tuttle. It was discovered independently by William Temple in December 1865 and Horace Tuttle in January 1866. It was then lost for 100 years before being rediscovered in 1965. Comet Temple-Tuttle orbits the Sun every 33 years. The Orionids have produced some amazing displays in the past. In 1966, thousands of meteors per minute fell within a 15-minute span. The meteor shower of 1833 was known as the night the stars fell. That night, an estimated 100,000 meteors per hour rained down on Earth. Take advantage of the moon-free sky Monday morning and watch the Leonid meteor shower. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future Star Talk segments, my email address is startalk@farmandcountry.org. For Farm and Country and Star Talk, this has been Keith Hubbard, reminding you to keep looking up.
Thanks to Keith for that report. Well, keeping up with the snow and cool weather theme of today's episode, that was not planned really, but that's just how the weather has shaped up for this this week. We're going to turn to what you need to know to maintain your home garden this winter. Whether you're still harvesting crops in your vegetable garden, or maybe you're just looking for new winter garden survival tips. Here in the studio with me now to share all about how to keep your winter gardens healthy and happy is Jess Lewis. She's the owner and gardener of Mama Garden Co. Jess, welcome back to Farm and Country.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back here.
Awesome. I'm so glad that you're here. Well, I mean, if it's cool with you, why don't we hop right into the fun and the chill of the fall winter season? I'd love to just hear a little bit more about how the season has been going for you and what's still going this time of year?
Absolutely. The season has been fantastic for us. Very long season this year. We literally just wrapped on Monday. The snow chased us right out of that garden. And that was it. We're just doing a lot of closing up gardens. But, you know, first, let's talk about what's still going in gardens, specifically vegetable gardens. A lot of people assume that once the snow is on the ground, that's it. We're wrapped. That is not the case. Crops that are still going, kale, broccoli, carrots, squash, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, radicchio, and one that is always so surprising to people because they think, oh, this is a tiny little leaf. It's not going to make the snow. And a lot of the case, parsley will go really, really far into the season. And it actually becomes much crunchier and sweeter as it keeps going, alongside sage, oregano, thyme, all of those usual really hearty herbs.
And I also learned, I was chatting with Iris at Gilroots Farm, and she was telling me how like certain types of crops taste better in the wintertime because, as you said, they get sweeter with the frost.
That's absolutely right. You don't want to be harvesting your carrots, any of your root veg, until after a few frosts. That will just make them so, so sweet. Perfect for soups and storage and all of that stuff.
Let's talk about what it means to close the garden up. What does that really entail and what kind of preparation can people be doing?
So when you're closing your garden up, one tip that I always like to tell people is cut your plants at the base of the plant. Do not pull them out by the root. The roots hold so many nutrients in them that will just degrade, decompose into your soil through the winter and early spring and really be beneficial for maintaining your soil health and quality in the on-season. Another thing that you can do for your soil, once you've cut the base of all of the plants and remove the dead foliage from the decomposing fruits. So if you have tomatoes that have fallen, a lot of the time, if you leave those, they'll bring rodents around during the off season. Not necessarily something that you want in and around your garden. And you definitely don't want to establish that as a source or a place that is a source of food for them. Soil amendments. I preach soil amendments. If you've worked with me and you're a client of mine, you know I am always nagging you about that.
Yeah, tell me more about that.
Let's talk about what we can use for soil amendments. You can use ash from your fireplace for soil amendments. Sprinkle that on top of your beds. That's really, really helpful. Gives a lot of nitrogen to the soil. Compost. Put your compost on your soil beds or on your beds. That is something that you want during the off season to, again, decompose into your soil, give it that extra boost so it's ready for the on season and rehabbed. Manure, another great thing. You can put chicken manure, you can put cow manure, anything. These are all great ways to amend soil. Something else that I like to do, especially for the plants that are still going right now, is to mulch with hay. You can use hay mulch. You can use wood chips, providing they don't have a ton of fungus on them. You can use a traditional root mulch that you can just get from the garden center.
So once you've done this preparation, what happens next?
Sure.
Yeah, it's like November now. What kind of maintenance should they be doing over the next few months?
Well, okay, so before we dive into maintenance, let's talk about bulbs, because that is something else that needs to go in now. I know when we talk about bulbs, everyone says, are you getting your spring bulbs? Are you getting your spring bulbs? Yes, spring bulbs typically do not go in the spring. You put them in the fall before the ground freezes up. That's all of your crocuses, your irises, your narcissus, daffodil. Snowdrops. Oh my gosh, those are some of my favorite. They're some of the first ones that peak up in early spring. And then you know that winter has broken and we're on our way back to warm, long, sunny days. Yes, bulbs go in right now. So does garlic seed. You can pop that in now. This leads into winter gardens, which are a thing. And no, we're not planting winter gardens while the ground is frozen. Winter gardens are something that we install during the on season that even in their dormant or dead phase still offer so much visual interest, texture and color. Through the winter, which a lot of people find really invigorating to be able to look outside and not just see a snowy white expanse, but see all of these textures and colors and even see wildlife interacting with these plants. So yeah, let's just start with ornamental grasses. These are some of my favorites for winter interest. Native species, always for me, native perennial, Carl Forrester grass, switchgrass, sea oats, little bluestem. All of these offer height variation, textural variation, different colors. You'll find that sea oats in particular are really, really sweet, and they make kind of a little sound when the wind blows through them.
Beautiful.
A lot of the time you'll see birds building their nests in some of the larger species like a Carl or a switch, which is also really exciting because you can go and look at their little eggs in the spring there. Yarrow is another great one, you know, and this bleeds in kind of to the conversation about bed prep. Don't cut your seed heads off. This is a, in my opinion, dated practice. Seed heads provide not just visual interest, they provide food for wildlife. If you leave the seed head, it allows the plant to propagate itself and resow itself and expand in the on season. And this is how you get that beautiful, lush, full garden in the on season. Shrubs that provide winter interest, dogwood. Oh my God. Oh my God. And if you get a variation of it or a variegated variety of dogwood. So dogwood will start with its green and white leaves. And then in the wintertime, the bark on it goes bright red. It is so beautiful.
Gorgeous.
Yeah, absolutely. And I find that it's one that my clients who are really invested in winter gardens always want to have more of.
Well, Jess, you are clearly a master of the plants. Like hearing the joy and excitement that comes through when you talk about plants and gardening is so evident. And I'm curious, for people who might be first-time winter gardeners, what kind of tips do you have?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when you're planning a winter garden, I would bear in mind height variance there. I would bear in mind things like color variation. So, you know, a lot of people think brown, black, that's it for wintertime. That's not true. In fact, you can get that beautiful red from the dogwood, or you can get it from holly. There's American holly, and there's also inkberry holly. Or there's also winterberry holly, which has those big clusters of red berries that, yes, the birds eat, but they're oftentimes so prolific that they can't get through all of it, and it remains there. Those are the two main factors I would bear in mind: is height, color, and texture. Put some sea oats in your garden; they're so much fun.
Well, before we sign off, Jess, I'm curious, how can people find you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm just Mama Garden Co. I mean, you can Google me. I am working with most nurseries in our county and even beyond that. They have my cards on stock. I'm also on Instagram at Mama Garden Co. That's it. That's how you can find me and here on Catskill Radio.
That's awesome. Well, I've been chatting with Jess Lewis, owner and gardener of Mama Garden Co. I'm sure we'll talk later with you probably in January or February when it's time to talk seedlings.
Absolutely. That's in the pipeline.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jess.
Thanks.
Well, before we sign off, I know spooky season has technically ended, but I just learned that this past week is actually, it's not too late to smash those pumpkins you might have gotten for Halloween or October. All throughout the month of November, you can join Sullivan County and Cornell Cooperative Extension's Smash Your Pumpkins event. You can head on over to Cornell Cooperative Extension's Sullivan County's Liberty Campus to smash your pumpkins. Keep pumpkins out of the landfill and compost them instead. To go ahead and do that, you can give Amber a call at 845-292-6552. It is BYOP, aka Bring Your Own Pumpkin, and the team supplies the rest of the necessary tools. You can find other events happening in your neighborhood on our website at wjffradio.org. This show was produced by the Radio Catskill editorial team and post-production by Ronald Kelson. Stick around. Up next, it's Catskill Character. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and PR. I'll catch you next week.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Morgan Outdoors, celebrating 20 years as a local source for hiking, snowshoeing, and discovering the great outdoors. On Main Street in Hurleyville, near the rail trail, morgan-outdoors.com. Hey there, I'm Jason Dole, letting you know